Foreign Madam and the White Yogi, a verse novel by Chris Mooney Singh. Episode 4. She joined him next week at the Melbourne Ashram. 7 years her junior, clean as a cog, he meshed with her through careful listening, and she felt good. Each had to give a talk, the road that brought me here. And so, paired off, each heard travellers' tales turn by turn. Margot shared about her previous marriage as if plaster had been ripped from a raw wound. She told of weekend barbecues with Kara, the sharp-nosed thing who came along with Ken. Ken and Pierre, best mates since the boiler room in San Remo's pasta factory, met each Sunday lunch. Your place or mine? As lovebirds snogged, peach-faced, inside their cage, Pierre was kissing Kara in Margot's kitchen, then sneaking off through the week. Perhaps a year. Ken went contract plumbing out on jobs, Pierre obliged by doing Kara's plumbing. Upset, Margot broke her narrative.
Her husband Ken and I were clueless, Yogi. I can't believe we were the best of friends. As our tribe of children now played hide-and-seek, 2 marriages were killed off over coleslaw.
She was bitter, Yogi thought.
It was betrayal.
And she broke down. He comforted her with a gentle rocking hug till she was calm. Collecting herself, she went on with the endgame.
2 settlements squeezed us dry. They bought their giant pad with a pool, their prize reward for a safety fence to keep dumped spouses out.
Have you ever been there? Yogi asked.
Kara's castle? Lord, no. She's a witch. Or at least, wily. The smarmy way she poisons my little girls, buying them up things to assuage her guilt. No, she is my usurper. Now Paul and Dell swim in that pool, oblivious on second weekends. It's such fun, Mummy, and we've got toys and a bigger bedroom. Well, I still feel like Margot in the middle, just like I did with my own 2 grasping sisters who ganged up on me, always in competition. Life doesn't play fair. It only praises winners. But win any way you can is Neanderthal. Yes, these days, Yogi, you and I are losers to those who scheme, who cheat, who steal the prize. The Pierre and Kara show is quite the norm.
I prefer to watch the ants trek up the wall.
Touched by her frank admission, Yogi said, "You're too good for such low life, dear Margot." Inwardly, his heart was sucker-punched.
"Perhaps," she offered, dabbing at red eyes, "but I cannot tell the workshop group all this."
"I know." And so he helped her tone things down without the shattered feelings and love storms ending straight, digestible, contained. The ashramites endured the girls who ran and skidded down each hall on slippery mats. Floor surfer Paul and pal Adele let out their skulls. The girls were less than precious pearls, scraping nails along each wall, or howling out like hell's showgirls inside the meditation hall. On scented carpet, their kiss curls flew and whirled, then Paul sat tall on Baba's chair. It was their fall from ashram grace. "Get out, you girls!" Each word stung like a small lead ball. Yogi also had to craft his talk. "When you are born into a house of straw and the wolf of bankruptcy huffs and puffs it down and Mum tells Dad, 'Just read my lips,' you start another business and I'm gone. You also want to hit the road this time. Your father is 2 Taurus. He's a boss. Bull-necked, he starts another secret firm with 99 shares, 1 for the accountant. He buys a maisonette, the final gesture, to prove his substance, thinking that is love. The business folds.
She's so very tired. Her heart's a Sunday roast skewered with steel. You have bailed already. They too divorce. It forces you to think that work and marriage is a hood of love with blindness hereditary. You drift in fear, go interstate. Your folks choose new partners, no time for you. Why buy in? The world's a boarding house, and you're just passing through to where and why? Marga was listening from her ashram bed. She couldn't speak, while enigmatic Shiva smiled from his poster on the wall. Margot felt a kinship. It sent her thinking back to girly years. A middle child, she was the stone wall standing between sisters, the listening ear, detached like him, a loner, the granite kid that chisel minds can't crack. They put her in their dolly pecking order. They thrust their chores into her skinny hands because a gang of superficial two fears silent thoughts are always judging them. Unable to find a matching heart at home, she stepped onto an aeroplane for Paris and got estranged through distance and by time. Two talks delivered, they were set to leave the ashram, that safe island. At last, sharing certificates were given to the students. Then there was the rush to rooms, rapid packing. He booked her cab and took them to the station. "I have to work on Monday. Thanks so much." "No sweat," he said. "I'm glad we got some time." He wasn't booked to leave until the morning. The girls got on and raced ahead. "Sit there," she pointed while Yogi dragged the bags. So nice to find a man to carry the cases. She tried to grin and cover what she'd said, but it was out. She dropped her guard. "I'm sorry. I didn't mean..." Suddenly, he felt his heart awash with love. She was an Iron Woman after all. And that was what he needed. A role to fill. The job description. Care. It came with baggage, even apron strings, yet now seemed so romantic to instantly have family ready-made. How cool was that? To just step in and play the role of dad. Naivety was offering his service. "It must be tough raising them alone," he said. Her eyes had turned to useless water. "Saturday, why don't you come on home?" She threw it out, trying to sound casual. "The girls will be going to their dads." A simple thing like "come on home" meant so much more to a lack of belonging too long on the road. So he agreed. "Sure, yes, I would love to." He pressed her to his cheek, then waved himself backward down the aisle in trips and stumbles as Margaret's girls giggled him off the train. Outside, he gazed at her, as she gazed back, a girl on either side. Would this work out? He saw that Margot in the middle had to balance desire and little girl's hard eyes. The train lurched forward on its polished rails, the racehorse in his head now running home. Single weekend. The house was hers again. She sat at the window, able now to breathe, able to sleep in, read Molière at breakfast. She felt relief at last from circumstances with rising hope her solo life might change. She was waiting for the ponytail to climb her driveway and arrive, birthing headfirst through the womb-like foliage. Her weeping elm concealed the entrance to her stairs and porch. Its arcane coolness reminded her of Mimi until a finger pressed upon her bell. Afternoon cracks gumnuts in the cockatoo thick trees. The Mozzie patrol starts up, an hour off from nightfall. Where two are simmering, reclined upon two sunbeds, savouring ice and lime juice in the sepia tint of dusk. She feels thrumming fingers, hears tapping on her skin, Morse code at her elbow, a parrot on a pear, the sucking tweets of lovebirds, kisses live in cages. She hears the ants and silence caught up next to her.
There's no gap in thinking. There's no need to chatter. She has sung him here to her. The easy breeze is chuckling. Great leaves are stepping stones. He takes his body warmth, shifting camp at sundown onto her sunken sofa. Buttons like shells are sprung, hooks unpicked, skirts and soul talk, unzip limbs, climb to clamp, Siamese twins at the loins, tides touch, probe, suck, swell, along wet beach, seals splash, backs arch, dive, come up, dive again, crash and wash of spasm, salty blow is glad to find a safe sanctuary. He tries to tell her anemone how this jump so fast. Will they swim past forehead jewels of salt, bodies gasp, archipelagos relax, after the storm, calm meniscus. What remains when sheets wearing the mark of the snail are sent to the wash? I hope you don't think that I do this often, she said, outstretched upon the bed. It's not first date, but is this all too sudden? Or am I too easy to be read? He laughed and almost cried. She was on cue, minus artifice, conceit or guile. I'm so lucky to be lying next to you. I have no money, prospects, style. I've seen all that, she said. It's all a lie. Nothing lasts except what's done with goodness. To the rest I kiss goodbye. He now saw what they'd begun, and spoke no words for fear the grace might fade. Instead, he gently stroked her hair, and the weekend raced on by, the sheets unmade, both floating on the bed of prayer. The cordless telephone was her new night toy. They chatted on like kids, discovering the silly. Girls and sundowned lovebirds were chirping in their cages. The bags were standing there, still ready to up and run. The weekend is too far. They need a stopgap plan. She reached along the wire. What time can you come? They now went out, yet had a thrifty knack, no liking for the restaurant-style romance. They drove to chanting nights in yoga pants to return with snoozing daughters in the back. Or toured the hills to see the German hamlets, like Harndorf, stone-built, lined with plane and elm, where Bavarian cheeses overwhelm the taste buds and strawberries from farmlets. The girls were quiet with the interloper who was driving Margot's Mazda car until they dropped him with his slung guitar at the bus stop. Then they showed their temper. "Why does he always have to come with us?" pouted Pauline, still prima donna sour. Adele just thought 100 miles an hour. Margot said, "All right, so what's the fuss? You don't like him, why?" They turned to stone. Nothing to do with him or the state of war. "Why can't it be the way it was before? With you and Papa back, just us alone." As the little girls paddled, like spaniels in the surf, she broke a long baguette and Swedish cheese, he bit Corella hard an apple. Scanning the flat sea, he saw a curving dolphin. "Look," he said, "it arced high as a flying gymnast levitating on waves." The girls were clicking shells and stones like eyes washed up from the stinging sea, but Paul was glancing back. "See, Adele, he's not as tall as Papa." "Adele's a sour pickle, a clammed-up pippy cockle. Would he ever open her butterfly hinge of shyness?" "He picks his nose," she whispered. It's late. The sinking sun dimmed down its local glam. Soon they were climbing hills. A fox popped into headlights in the dark throat of her street. They put the girls to bed. "Good night," he also tried. A painful pause. No sound. Crestfallen, he crept out to her unrolling a futon. "They don't like me. They need some time, more time." Her brow had lines of stress,
Should I be here tonight? They're scared. It's all too fast. Look, I am divorced for years, and so are my torn darlings. It's time they get past it. I'm glad you're here, she said. Let's go to bed. I need you. Hey, let's go to the Cape Pole Forest. The girls at Papa's for Saturday. I want to walk beneath pine trees, imagining we're near the river Oise. I suppose we can, it's Saturday. So let's get up, pack a picnic. But what's all this, the river Oise? Shame, she said to him, just wait. Or we could hang here, have a picnic under the pear tree when it warms up. So dull, she said. I just can't wait to push you over in the pine needles. All right, I'm getting up. I was joking. I'll get the car. Damn it. Here come pins and needles. My legs are absolutely dead. Come on, move it. She threw the car keys off with a sheet. Go bathe, you slug, or bang, you're dead. Laughing, he rose naked, running from bedroom to the shower head. Hey, turn it on, the hot tap switch. It's freezing. Ah! And soon was running, wet and dripping, back to his jeans flung on the chair. Cold flicked a switch inside his head. He saw pine trees, the picnic rug, two pairs of blue jeans kicked off in the Cape Pole Forest. He doesn't know about Oise near Paris. She went there one weekend to a dark wood by the river's voice, perched in the treehouse of a friend, where Grandma Mimi's old wise witch had pounded flowers into spells, or so Margot had dreamed through rich imagination's far church bells. In that old time she had sat high in the treehouse of the ancient oak with Slaterman, her army guy, who'd found that spot on her neck to stroke. Those had been her first high days. Was it lust or was it flu? With Yogi she now shared her ways, hoping the spell would turn old new. She knew already he would say the words. She had spoken to her higher yes or no. Her breathing was a prayer for that yes day, and senses through the starlings out the back, who chirped before the coming rain, the words were imminent. She knew his mind was turning like a fern toward the sun as he to her, so kept her tongue on hold. Contemplation, lifted from its object, was changing channels on the radio. Perhaps that pulled her marriages apart. Did she fiddle the dial, lose the channel? Could a pushing will have pulled her men away to other women? She couldn't tell. Yet old hang-ups had gossiped until now. She conjured Grandma Mimi in her mind, calm as a lake through wars and after wars, when Jim, her husband, died on Juno Beach before the Canadian Third pushed onto Holland. She'd kept a store and put her faith in this grandchild, Margaret, who also hoped so much to be a Mimi for her bells. Margot kept her own words for that day, resigned to let the way now have its say. Cherish, Mr. New, two loves are dead. Her thoughts were waking him to start his race and worked his napping body on her bed. Aroused, he flowed into her mouth's hot space and reached his peace. Then sideways, near her face, the afternoon spoke up. Are you alive? It's time, you fool, he said. Let's go for a drive. At road's end, where shores lap the mountain's neck and wet rats die for cover, trout leap, then depart through bracelets of water, and the whispering wall waits like a huge stone piano of tinkled sounds. The reservoir handrail sings the song cycles of the wind, echoes march forward out of time. Here one's speech is amplified across the valley, as if an intelligence may be listening in with a mortared wall. Like a giant curved eardrum, as clear as an echo in the theatre of epithesis.
speaking up to Tess, out of sight of each other. His voice travels through the dusk to her, touched by the soft intonations of late summer. The swallows like Chinese ribbons above the valley, the washing sound of this night animal drinking place, and they both understand the scraping voices in the branches, the falling rock, the caw of the crow, eddying wind across big tom-tom water, the trout's high striving, the rabbit's shudder, all heard in this valley of high waters. A pulse throbs in her neck. His dry throat attempts its missionary action, yet the poetry of proposal is not easy. His future wants to come clean, but the wall stands firm. It's not so easy to say what one means by words, yet words are the only bricks in the wall of the air, energy collecting firm into shapes of passion. He clears his throat like a crow with a cold and proposes marriage to his unseen listener. Particles vibrate along the curved mortar, travel to the other side of the reservoir. Yes, yes, returns her echo in the hush of dusk. Yes, again, in the concerto of wind and all action, in the concord of mountains, in the valley of high waters. You've been listening to Foreign Madam and the White Yogi, a verse novel by Chris Mooney Singh. Join me next week for another episode. Until then, goodbye.